Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, good evening, everyone. Okay, today we take for a study the Mahagosinga Sutta. This is the Greater Discourse in Gosinga. It's Sutta number 32 of the Majjhima Nikaya. The sutta that we studied last week was the Chula Gosinga Sutta. That's the shorter discourse at Gosinga. So both of these suttas take place in the same place. This is the Gosinga Sala tree wood. Okay, and when this sutta opens, the Buddha is living in this Gosinga Sala tree wood together with a number of very eminent elder disciples. And here the introduction tells us who was there: the Venerable Sariputta, Venerable Mahamoggallana, Venerable Mahakassapa, Venerable Anuruddha, Venerable Revata, the Venerable Ananda, and some other well-known elder disciples. And this sutta will give each of these monks a chance to display their own special area. And so this sutta will serve as a kind of introduction to some of these most eminent elder disciples of the Buddha. And so the sutta opens one evening. Usually during the afternoon, the monks all go into seclusion and sit in meditation. Then in the evening, this is actually probably the late afternoon, what we would call the late afternoon, then they come out from seclusion. And on this occasion, when Venerable Moggallana comes out from meditation, he goes to Venerable Mahakassapa and he says to him, "Let us go to see the Venerable Sariputta in order to listen to the Dhamma." It seems they were originally expecting to get a discourse from the Venerable Sariputta. And so Moggallana and Mahakassapa start going off to the place where Sariputta is staying. And then the Venerable Anuruddha joins them. Then the Venerable Ananda sees them going to the Venerable Sariputta. And he goes to another monk named Revata and suggest that they go to the Venerable Sariputta. And so we have this group of eminent disciples going to see Venerable Sariputta with the thought, I think, of asking him to give a discourse on the Dhamma. Okay, so when they arrive at the place where Venerable Sariputta is staying, then Venerable Sariputta welcomes them. And then he starts off by addressing Venerable Ananda. Instead of giving a discourse on his own, first he comments on this night. It must have been a full moon night, or the moon would have been close to the full moon. So this moonlight is flooding through the forest. And here, and I notice in the United States, when we have a full moon, one hardly sees the moonlight at all. I mean, one can look up and see the full moon, but one doesn't get any special effect from moonlight coming down to earth. But I know in Sri Lanka, when there's a full moon, I don't think that the moon is especially brighter over Sri Lanka than over the United States. But for some reason, the moonlight just floods down so strongly that it's so bright outside that it's almost like daylight. except that there's enough night around so that one knows that it's night. But when the moonlight comes down to the ground, it illuminates things so brightly that one could almost take a book out and read under the moonlight. And so Venerable Sariputta comments that this forest, this wood is very delightful. Probably there were flowers growing in the trees, and as the light breezes would blow, they would sweep the scent of the flowers through the forest. And so he says that this night is moonlit, the sal trees are all in blossom, and heavenly scents seem to be floating in the air. So there's this very beautiful scent in the air that comes from the flowers and the trees. You know, when I was staying in Kandy, my place in Kandy, the forest hermitage, there was a tree right outside. It's called a Na tree, which means it's translated as ironwood. And this tree has little flowers. And on some nights when I would go outside onto the court in front of the hermitage, or sometimes coming out very early in the morning when it's still dark, one gets this beautiful scent from those flowers. But what's interesting is that always the scent would hit one when one isn't expecting it or isn't anticipating it. But if one makes a conscious effort after getting the first smell of that fragrance, beautiful fragrance, one thinks, ah, this is nice, I want to experience it again. Then if one makes the deliberate effort to smell it, one smells nothing. It vanishes. It seems it only manifests when one doesn't have any craving or attachment to the scent. Because it's such a subtle scent. Okay, so now Venerable Sariputta, instead of giving these other monks a discourse, he opens up a subject for conversation. And he asks, what kind of monk, friend Ananda, could illuminate or could beautify this sal, Gosinga sal tree forest? And so now he asked Venerable Ananda for his opinion on this issue. And now Venerable Ananda is going to speak according to his own conception of an ideal monk. Now, in order to understand Venerable Ananda's answer, one has to know a little bit of Venerable Ananda's role in the Sangha. Yeah, Venerable Sariputta, Venerable Ananda was appointed by the Buddha as the monk who is foremost in a number of categories, about four or five categories. And one of these categories is that he was the monk who is foremost in learning, in listening to many discourses. Because in the Buddha's time, in this period of ancient India, writing was not used, at least it was not used as a means for preserving religious texts. And so in order to learn religious texts, one has to listen to them. So the word that's translated as learned is bahu sutta, which means one who has heard much. So Ananda was appointed the foremost in the whole Sangha of monks as the monk who has learned the most, because Ananda would always try to learn all of the discourses that the Buddha spoke. And when other monks would give discourses, the Buddha would ask them about them and try to retain them in his mind. And Venerable Ananda was distinguished not only for the amount of his learning, but it's also said that he was the monk who was foremost in memory, the monk who had the most outstanding memory, the capacity to retain what he had learned. And so the Venerable Ananda came to be called the treasurer of the Dhamma. In Pali, it's Dhamma Bhandagarika. And after the Buddha's passing away, when the Sangha met, had a council in order to establish the fixed form of the Dhamma, the suttas, they asked Venerable Ananda to take on the leading role in rehearsing or reciting the suttas, the discourses of the Buddha. And the commentary explains, sometimes commentaries are not always believable, but maybe on this point they are, that in some earlier life, under an earlier Buddha, Venerable Ananda had made the aspiration or vow to become the treasurer of the Dhamma under some future Buddha. And so, after many, many lives of cultivating meritorious deeds and practicing the Dhamma under earlier Buddhas, then during the time of Gautama or Shakyamuni Buddha, he was naturally assumed that role of being the treasurer of the Dhamma. And so when Sariputta asked Ananda to state his conception of what kind of monk would beautify or adorn this Gosinga Sala wood forest, salflower forest, he replies, on top of page 308, "Here, friend Sariputta, a monk is one who has learned much, remembers what he has learned, and consolidates what he has learned. And those teachings that are good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end, with the right meaning and phrasing, and which affirm or which elucidate a holy life that is utterly perfect and pure, such teachings as these he has learnt much of, remembered or retained in mind, mastered verbally, that is by reciting them again and again, until he is able to retain these teachings well in mind, since it's verbal recitation which helps to impress the discourse in the memory. Then he's investigated or examined with the mind, and he's penetrated well by view." What's interesting here, you might just pass this by without noticing, but if we take these five terms and look at them closely, we can see that they actually constitute a gradual step-by-step process of learning and mastering the Dhamma. First, these teachings, it says he has learned much of. But literally, it's he has heard much of. He's listened to many teachings. So the first stage is to listen to the teaching. Then while one is listening, one has to train the memory to preserve, to retain exactly what one has heard. And you see, in our time, because this has become a literate culture, along with literacy, we have to pay a price. I pay it, we all pay it. That price is deterioration in the retentive capacity of the mind. In a culture which is non-literate, or in which literacy and reading is not particularly emphasized, the retentive faculty or capacities of the brain, the retentive capacity of the brain is much more voluminous and much more precise than for us literate people. I used to notice in Sri Lanka when I would go driving sometimes with the driver from the Buddhist Publication Society, you know, he was not a very highly learned man. He didn't spend a lot of time reading. And so sometimes we would have to stop for directions, and somebody would explain to him rather complex directions. And if I were there, I would have to have a sheet of paper and be writing them down. But he would just hear the directions and he would be able to remember them, because that capacity of the mind, it's stronger when the mind is not spoiled by reading. So Peter, you could give a course in your university, in your college, no textbooks. You just give a pure lecture course, and then you have to test your students. And maybe if you do this with the same group of students, semester after semester after semester, their memories will improve greatly. But for that to work, all the other teachers also have to abolish books. Okay, so the second stage is remembering what one has heard, bearing it in mind. Then to keep it in mind, if one doesn't practice what one has learned and brought into the mind, is going to fade out. And so to get it deeply impressed on the mind, what is done is verbal recitation. And what in monasteries that emphasize study and learning a lot, especially where there's a lot of emphasis on memorization of texts, what monks do is in the evening they have this walkway they call a chankama or sakman. It's like a walkway, just like the area where one does walking meditation. And they walk back and forth reciting the text over and over, beginning slowly and then increasing the speed until they can recite the text very quickly. And so, in some of the Asian countries, Asian Buddhist countries, there are monks who are able to memorize like whole volumes and whole collections from the Tripitaka. And in Burma, in the 20th century, there were several monks who were able to memorize the entire Tripitaka. Even now, there's some monks who are able to retain in their memories the entire Tripitaka. And this is done by... It's said that once one starts memorizing texts, once one gets the knack of the technique, then it becomes easier to memorize additional texts. So it doesn't take so much effort once one becomes experienced in memorizing texts. Okay, so one remembers what one has learned, masters it verbally. But if you just have verbal mastery, then you can be just like a parrot reciting back. Parrot, speak this sutra, and the parrot will start reciting. But the purpose of the Buddha's teaching is not just to be transmitted by human beings who are like tape recorders or MP3 files, but to gain understanding. So the fourth stage is to examine, to investigate the meaning with the mind. Then after one examines with the mind, then what comes after that is to practice the teaching that's explained in the Dhamma. That's not indicated in this particular passage, but we see this in the series described in Sutta number 95 of the Middle Length Discourses. And then when one's practice reaches maturity, then one would penetrate the meaning of the teaching, penetrate it with wisdom, with insight. And so that is what is meant by penetrated well by view, the fifth stage. Okay, and then the monk that's being described by Venerable Ananda isn't one who merely learns the teaching for himself, but Venerable Ananda was also a very talented preacher, the lecturer. And so the ideal monk that he describes is one who teaches the Dhamma to the four assemblies. What are the four assemblies? It's the assembly of monks, the assembly of nuns, that's the Bhikkhu Sangha, Bhikkhuni Sangha, the assembly of Upasakas, that is male lay followers, and the assembly of Upasikas, that's women lay followers. So he teaches the Dhamma to the people in the four assemblies with what is called well-rounded and coherent statements and phrases. So his formulation of the teaching is very delightful to listen to. It's both informative, inspiring, and the teaching is delivered for the purpose of, this is the underlying purpose, eradicating the anusayas. What are the anusayas? These are the deep underlying tendencies towards the defilements. Sometimes some texts mention seven anusayas, like Majjhima Nikaya number 18. On page 202, we have the underlying tendency to lust, the underlying tendency to aversion, the underlying tendency to views, the underlying tendency to doubt, the underlying tendency to conceit, the underlying tendency to craving for conditioned existence, and the underlying tendency to ignorance, to avidya. Okay, so those are the underlying tendencies or dispositions towards these defilements. And the final aim of the Buddha's practice, the path, is to eradicate these underlying tendencies. And so Venerable Ananda says that this is the kind of monk who can illuminate this Gosanga solitary forest. Okay, now Venerable Sariputta turns to another monk called Venerable Revata. I believe that this Venerable Revata was the younger brother of Sariputta. Sariputta had a number of younger brothers, a number of younger sisters, and his younger brothers all became monks, and his younger sisters all became nuns, bhikkhunis. But his mother was a very devout Brahmin lady who was very devoted to Brahmanism. And so she was very upset when all of her sons and daughters became Buddhist monks and Buddhist nuns. And she always held this against her eldest son, Sariputta, thinking that he was the one who led all of the other children astray. Except when Venerable Sariputta was very ill and was going to die. Then he went to his mother's house, the family house. His mother must have been about 100 years old, since Sariputta would have been maybe over 80 years old at the time. And he decided that he would die in his mother's house. And then while he was lying on his deathbed, during the night, different deities came to visit him to pay final respects to him. Saka, the king of the Devas, came one night. Other deities came other night. And each night his mother would see brilliant lights coming out from her son's room. And then finally Mahabrahma came to pay his respects to Sariputta. And then she saw the most brilliant light coming out from the room that night. And then she asked her son, why each night are these brilliant lights coming out from your room? And then Sariputta said that these are the various deities who have come to say farewell to me, including your favorite deity, Mahabrahma. And then his mother was struck. How can these deities be coming to pay respects to my own son? Does that mean he's greater than these deities? And then she asked her son if this was the case, and he said that one who has finished the practice and the Buddha's teaching is superior even to all of these deities. And then she wondered, what is the Buddha himself like? And then Sariputta started to describe the qualities of the Buddha, and then her mind became transformed, and she gained confidence in the Buddha's teaching. And then she became a Sotapanna, a stream enterer. Okay, so now Venerable Sariputta addresses this question to Venerable Revata. And we don't meet Venerable Revata very often in the suttas, because he was not a very extroverted person, not one who became much involved in Sangha affairs, but he always liked to live in seclusion, practicing meditation. And so Sariputta asks Revata, he says, first, the Venerable Revata has spoken according to his own inspiration or his own ideal. Now I'm asking you, in your opinion, what kind of monk will illuminate this Gosinga solitary wood? And now, since Venerable Revata is one who is devoted to solitary meditation, he explains according to his own ideal. He says, here, Sariputta, a bhikkhu delights in solitary meditation and takes delight in solitary meditation. He is devoted to internal serenity of mind. This is ajatang cheto samatang anuyuto. So this is emphasizing here the practice of samatha meditation, or tranquility meditation. Then he does not neglect meditation, but I think this would be better translated, he is not devoid of jhana. That means through the practice of samatha, tranquility meditation, he's one who attains the jhanas, the meditative absorptions. But it's not only the jhanas that he possesses, but vipassanaya samanagato. He's one who also possesses insight. So he practices meditation in order to gain insight, which is the instrument for the development of panya, wisdom. And he's one who dwells in empty huts, or better, one who frequently resorts to empty dwellings. So that's the ideal, most suitable place for practicing solitary meditation, is to go to a little straw hut in the forest, or maybe on top of a mountain, high in the mountains. Where one can be shielded from the elements and then practice meditation very peacefully. So this is Revata's ideal of the monk. Okay, now Sariputta turns to another monk, Venerable Anuruddha, and says, the Venerable Revata has spoken according to his own inspiration, his own ideal. Now I'm asking you, what kind of monk do you think will adorn or beautify this Gosinga solitary wood? Okay, Venerable Anuruddha was a member of the Sakyan clan. So he was a cousin of the brother, cousin of the brother, a cousin of the Buddha. And after the Buddha became enlightened and became known amongst the Sakyans, in Anuruddha's branch of the family, many of the Sakyan families decided that one of their sons should go to become a monk under the Buddha. And in Anuruddha's branch of the family, there were two brothers who were of mature age. One was Anuruddha, and the other, the older brother, was named Mahanama. So they were trying to decide between them which one should go to the Buddha and become ordained as a monk. And initially, Anuruddha wasn't inclined to become a monk, so he was trying to put the responsibility on his older brother, Mahanama. He said, why don't you go and become ordained as a monk? So then Mahanama said, well, if I get ordained as a monk, you're going to have to take care of the household duties. So that, see, Anuruddha was brought up almost like a spoiled child because his other elder brother was handling the household duties. So Anuruddha asked Mahanama, what are the household duties? Well, you see, the Sakyans were an administrative clan. And so besides they would have to oversee the cultivation of the fields. So Mahanama explained to Anuruddha, well, in the springtime, you have to see to the sowing of the fields. First, the plowing of the fields. Then you have to see to the sowing of the fields. Then you have to supervise all of the workers out in the fields. Then you have to check each day that the crops are growing well, see that they're properly watered. Then when the harvest time comes, you have to see that the crops are brought in, that they're cut properly and brought in. Then you have to see that the rice is threshed properly. Then you have to see that the chaff is discarded and the good grains of rice are kept in the storerooms. And so there's quite a lot of work in managing the household affairs. Then when Anuruddha heard this, he said, you stay as the householder. I'll become ordained as the monk. First he asked Mahanama after the harvest season, and then he said, what comes after the harvest season? Then Mahanama said, well, pretty soon is the next sowing season. So then you have to see that the fields are plowed again, that the crops are sown again, and then you have to go through this whole cycle again. Then Anuruddha asks, isn't there ever any end to this? Then Mahanama said, no, as long as you're alive, you have to go through every year the same cycle. Then Anuruddha said, you remain as a householder. I'll get ordained as a monk. Okay, then when Anuruddha was ordained as a monk, initially he had some problem with his meditation, but he developed very quickly the faculty that's called the divine eye. This is the Dibhachakku. And this divine eye, it's a special faculty of vision by which one can see other realms of existence that are normally invisible to human beings. One can see the higher realms, the various heavenly realms. One could see the lower realms, the realm of the pretas or tormented spirits, and the hell realms. And one could also use the divine eye to see other world systems far away from our world system. Just the way when we go out at night, on a very clear night, we might be able to see many stars, constellations. But with the divine eye, I guess it's like having a super powerful Hubble telescope within one's own forehead. One could see maybe even 100 times, 1,000 times in greater detail than the Hubble telescope can see. And because Aniruddha developed the divine eye at a very early point in his practice, he became attached to it. And he had this clinging to this supernormal power, and also he became proud of it. So his pride and his attachment became two barriers to his further progress, and both of them created a certain agitation or restlessness in the mind. So one time, I think he had penetrated to the third stage of liberation, the stage of anagami, but he wasn't able to reach the stage of arhatship. And so he came to Venerable Sariputta and told him that his faculties are very well developed and he has this power of the divine eye, but he's still not able to make the final breakthrough. Then Sariputta told him, the reason you can't make this breakthrough is because you have this attachment to the divine eye, and you're proud on that account, and your mind is becoming restless because of that. If you just give up your attachment, lay down your pride, then you'll find your mind will become calm, and then you can progress further to the final stage. Aniruddha did this, and then he reached final realization. And so when Sariputta asked Aniruddha, what do you think, what is your opinion, what kind of monk could illuminate or beautify this Kosinga solitary forest? Venerable Aniruddha speaks according to his own experience. He says, here, friend Sariputta, with the divine eye which is purified and superior to human vision, a bhikkhu surveys 1,000 worlds. This is 1,000, probably 1,000 world systems. So it might be like 1,000 galaxies, not just 1,000 planets, but 1,000 galaxies. And then to illustrate this, he gives an example. He says, just as a man with good sight, when he has climbed to the upper palace chamber, the upper chamber of a palace, he might be able to look out at the ground and see 1,000 wheels lay down on the ground. So too, with the divine eye which is purified and surpasses the human, a bhikkhu surveys 1,000 worlds or 1,000 world systems. And it's interesting that the text compares this viewing of the worlds to seeing wheels. Because if you've ever seen photographs of many of the galaxies, they look very much like wheels. It's one of the basic patterns of a galaxy, is kind of circular, going out like a wheel. The Milky Way is also a circular galaxy. Okay, so Aniruddha explains according to his conception. Then Sariputta turns to Venerable Mahakasapa and says, now we ask Venerable Mahakasapa, what kind of monk could illuminate this Kosanga solitary forest? Now Mahakasapa was another monk who was not very sociable, who stayed very often in seclusion. And Mahakasapa's specialization, the quality in which he was most distinguished, was the observation or the observance of what are called the duttangas. I'll write that. The duttangas are we might call them, translate this as the ascetic practices or the austere practices. And Mahakasapa might have been inclined to the austere practices because, according to the commentaries, he grew up in luxury. According to the background story of Mahakasapa, he came from a Brahmin family. This one could tell from the name, since Kasapa, or in Sanskrit Kashyapa, it's a Brahminical name. And it was quite a wealthy, well-established Brahmin family. And from a young age, it's said that he had a natural inclination to lead a life of renunciation. But he was under a lot of pressure from his family to marry. And the commentary gives a little story which is charming, but so often one can't always believe commentarial stories, but I'll tell it anyway. Mahakasapa was obstinate in saying, "I'm not going to marry, I want to renounce, I want to renounce." But his parents said, "You have to get married, you have to get married." So Mahakasapa had some sculptor make, according to his own conception, a statue of a beautiful girl, and said, "If you can find me a girl that looks exactly like this, I will marry her. But if you can't, then I'll lead the ascetic life." And the parents agreed to that. And so they sent men out looking all over India trying to find a girl that looks exactly like the girl in the statue that Mahakasapa, or that Kasapa had made. Now, there was another girl who wanted to lead an ascetic life. And she said, "I'm not going to marry. I want to lead an ascetic life. I want to lead an ascetic life." But her parents said, "No, you have to get married. You have to get married." But she was really very sorrowful at this demand her parents were placing on her to get married. Then the men went searching all over the different towns in this area of India, but they couldn't find any girl that looked like the one in the statue. And just when they were exhausted in their search, they came to one last house and opened the door and they asked, "Do you happen to have a daughter?" And they said, "Yes, we have a daughter. May I see her?" They brought the men in to see the daughter. And the daughter looked exactly like the girl in the statue that Mahakasapa had commissioned. And this girl, who should she turn out to be? But that same girl who had made that resolution, "I don't want to get married, I don't want to get married, I want to lead an ascetic life." And so both of them were brought together and forced to become married, to get married. But on the wedding night, Kasapa didn't take any action towards his wife. And she asked him, why are you just staying back there all by yourself? And he said, "My original decision was to lead an ascetic life, and I never wanted to get married." And she said, "For me too, my determination is to lead an ascetic life." But they realized that they would have to remain in the household life for some time. I think until Kasapa's parents passed away. I don't know how long that was. And then, together, they never consummated their marriage, but they would both stayed and observed celibacy through their marriage until Kasapa's parents passed away. Then, one day, in the middle of the night, so nobody in the household would know. They both got up. What they did was to put aside their fine clothing, and they took the clothing of servants and put them on. And then they went out from the household and they dyed these clothes, the saffron or ochre color of ascetics, and they set out together to find a spiritual teacher. They both sort of made a determination. They had never heard about the Buddha, but they made the determination, we will go out and search to find one who is enlightened in this world. And so they went out searching, and they went on different paths, since it wouldn't have looked appropriate for a man and a woman ascetic to be walking alone together. People would think that these are people pretending to be ascetics, but they're actually having a sexual relationship. So then one day, as Kassapa was walking someplace around between Rajagaha and Nalanda, he saw the Buddha sitting in meditation under a tree. And the Buddha knew that Kassapa would be coming that way, and so he deliberately went off the road and sat under the tree, exactly in that place. And so as soon as Kassapa saw the Buddha sitting there, he knew that this is my spiritual master. And so he came right up to the Buddha, bowed down in front of him, and said, "You are my teacher, I am your disciple. You are my teacher, I am your disciple." Then the Buddha said to Kassapa, he said, "If, because you are so pure, determined, and sincere in your devotion and your aspiration, if any teacher who has not realized the truth were to say to you, I have realized the truth,' because of that falsehood, he would die on the spot." It said that his head would split into seven parts, which is a way of saying that he would die on the spot. "But Kassapa, I can say to you, I have realized the truth." So then Kassapa came to take the Buddha as his teacher. Then the Buddha gave Kassapa some brief instructions. And the Buddha did something very interesting and important at this point. The Buddha took his robe and offered it to Kassapa and said, "You wear my robe and you give me your robe." And so the Buddha exchanged robes with Kassapa, which is, I don't think the Buddha has ever done this with any other disciple. And then the Buddha gave Kassapa some very concise instructions. And then Kassapa practiced according to those instructions for 7 days. Then on the 8th day, he achieved full liberation. He achieved arhatship. But after his enlightenment, Kassapa did not often stay with the Sangha, or with a group of disciples. But he would often stay by himself in the hills outside Rajagaha, meditating high in the hills. But what would be surprising in a person of this temperament, but he was also a poet and recited many verses praising the beauty of the mountains, the beauties of the forest, the delight of meditation, meditating in solitude. And these are collected in the Theragatha, the Psalms or poems of the elder monks. It's one of the largest collections of poems in the Theragatha. And so Mahakassapa's specialty became the practice of the duttangas, the austere or ascetic practices. And so when Mahakassapa explains his ideal of a monk, he says, "Here a bhikkhu is a forest dweller himself, That is, he lives only in the forest. He doesn't live in any monastery in the town or in the city. And he speaks in praise of forest dwelling. That's one of the ascetic practices, is to make the resolution to live only in the forest, never to live in the town or city. And he is one who eats only alms food, only the food that he collects on alms round. And he speaks in praise of going on alms round and eating alms food. That is, he will not accept any invitation from householders to go to their house for a meal. If he's staying in a temple or monastery and people bring food, he will not accept it. Perhaps only if he's very sick and can't go on alms round. But his regular practice is always to go on alms round and to eat only what he receives on alms round. Because this is a way of developing equanimity. Because sometimes if one goes on alms round, people are not prepared, and so one will get poor quality food. Sometimes one will get very well-prepared, luxurious food. If people are expecting this monk to come, then one has to know moderation and try to become detached from this delicious food. Mahakasapa's own practice was to go on alms round when he was living near a town, to go to the poor section of the town, because he wanted to give poor people a chance to do deeds of merit. Okay, another ascetic practice is to be what's called a refuse rag wearer. This is called pangsukulika, and one speaks in praise of wearing refuse rag robes. Okay, now there are two kinds of robes. Well, nowadays, one doesn't find many refuse rag wearers, but one is a robe which is already made by householders. The other is a robe which is made by finding pieces of discarded cloth and cutting them up and sewing them together and dyeing them to make a robe. And usually to find the suitable type of cloth, do you know where the ascetics have to go to get it? The charnel ground. This is because when bodies are thrown or discarded in the charnel ground, they're wrapped in a piece of white cloth. And so the ascetics and monks would go to the charnel ground and remove the cloth from the corpse and cut pieces from several cloths and then sew them together to make a robe. And if one takes this vow to observe this ascetic practice, if somebody comes with a robe that's been already prepared by a professional tailor, one refuses it. Okay, so that's one ascetic practice. Another ascetic practice is to use only the three robes. That is, there's an underrobe, which is like a skirt. There's the upper robe, which is called the Uttarasanga, which is like this. And then there's a double thick robe called the Sangati. So those are the three robes that a monk normally has, but most monks will have an extra robe of one or another kind, usually an extra underrobe and an extra uttarasanga, upper robe, to use when one is washing the other robe. But if one takes the triple robe practice, then one has only those three robes. But one has another cloth, which is called the bathing cloth, because in India they would go bathing in the rivers or in ponds, not in enclosed showers. And so they have this cloth to wear. when bathing. And so when one is washing the underrobe, then one will wear the bathing cloth. So these ascetic practices, the Buddha permitted monks to observe, because this was part of the heritage of the Indian ascetic tradition. And observing these practices leads to contentment, equanimity, fewness of wishes, to fortitude and inner strength. Okay, so some other things praised by Mahakasapa. The monk is one who has few desires, not many desires, and speaks in their praise. He is content and speaks in praise of contentment. He has secluded himself, he likes seclusion, and praises seclusion. He is one who keeps aloof from society and speaks in praise of aloofness from society. These are the kinds of personal qualities of Mahakasapa. He is energetic himself and speaks in praise of energy. Then he is one who observes sila or moral practices himself and speaks in praise of the observance of sila. Again, he is one who has mastered samadhi himself and praises the mastery of samadhi, concentration. He is one who has attained to wisdom himself and speaks in praise of the attainment of wisdom. He is one who has achieved liberation and speaks in praise of liberation. And he is one who has attained the knowledge and vision of liberation and speaks in praise of attaining the knowledge and vision of liberation. So for Mahakasapa, that's the kind of monk that he admires most and that he thinks would illuminate or beautify the sal tree forest. Okay, then Sariputta turns to his close friend Mahamoggallana and asks him what kind of monk he thinks could illuminate this Gosinga solitary forest. Then, according to this text, Moggallana replies, "Here, friend Sariputta, two bhikkhus engage in a talk on," the Pali says, "on the Abhidhamma, and they question each other, and each being questioned by the other answers without foundering, and their talk rolls on, continues on, in accordance with the Dhamma." Actually, a better translation, "and their Dhamma talk continues on." It would be a more literal, better translation. Okay, two things are surprising here. First, one is that this answer is given by Moggallana, because Moggallana's specialization was not talk on the Dhamma. But what was Moggallana's specialization? Yeah, the psychic powers. And so it's somewhat puzzling that this answer is ascribed to Moggallana. But now what is interesting is there are parallels to the sutta in the Chinese agamas. And at least in one of them, maybe two of the agama versions, when Mahamoggallana gives his answer, he states that here a monk is one who possesses the psychic powers. And then he enumerates the different psychic powers, as, for example, we find them explained in Sutta number 6 of the Majjhima Nikaya, the ability to multiply one's body, and then to, from the many bodies, one has one body, one can walk through walls and through mountains, one can fly through the air like a bird, one could walk on water, one could dive into the earth, and so on. And so in these other parallel versions from the Chinese Tripitaka, the answer given about that the monk can speak well and carry on this discussion without any hesitation, this is ascribed to another disciple of the Buddha, whose name in Pali is Mahakachana. But in the Pali version, that answer is ascribed to Mahamoggallana. Okay, the second point, which is a little surprising, is that we have the word here, Abhidhamma. And so this raises the question, did the Abhidhamma Pitaka actually exist in the time of the Buddha? Actually, according to all reliable historical research, we could be quite certain that nothing comparable to the Abhidhamma Pitaka, to the developed Abhidhamma Pitaka, existed in the Buddha's time. So the word Abhidhamma, as used in the early texts, could mean, and what's interesting is that when the word Abhidhamma occurs in the sutta texts, it always occurs in relation to a discussion going on between disciples. It's never said to be something that the Buddha teaches the Abhidhamma, but it's always when disciples are having a discussion amongst themselves, then one sees the phrase Abhidhamma. So probably in the early period, what Abhidhamma meant was a more detailed, specialized, maybe somewhat more technical treatment of the Dhamma, of the teaching, than one will find in the actual discourses of the Buddha. And it was probably from this tradition of monks discussing in a somewhat more technical, specialized way the Dhamma, the Buddha's teaching, that eventually these discussions led to the formation of a systematic, complex philosophy. And then the word Abhidhamma came to be assigned to that, the result of those discussions, the complex, systematic version of the Dhamma that emerged. And then over time, full treatises were composed, and they came to be called the Abhidhamma Pitaka. I would say maybe two examples of what we might think of as early Abhidhamma in this Majjhima Nikaya might be suttas number 43 and 44. We could see in those suttas, one is a discussion between Sariputta and Moggallana. The other is a discussion between a bhikkhuni, a nun named Dhammadina, and a layman. But we could see there that questions are asked which seem to be more technical, more specialized than the kind of discourse, than the teaching that we find in the actual discourses of the Buddha. Okay, so this is the answer that Moggallana gives according to the Pali version, according to the Chinese counterpart, the answer of Mahakachayana. Okay, now when all of the monks have been asked by Sariputta and they all finish speaking, then Mahamoggallana speaks to Venerable Sariputta and says to him, "Now we've all spoken according to our own inspiration or our own ideals. Now it's your turn. You're in the hot seat now. What kind of monk do you think could illuminate this Kosanga solitary forest?" Now Sariputta's specialization that we could see from other discourses is to give somewhat more detailed, more analytical presentations of the Dhamma. And that is probably why Sariputta later became associated with the formation of the Abhidhamma. Probably it was monks in the company of Sariputta, followers of Sariputta, who specialized in this more technical analysis of the teaching. And so it was within that group that the systematic Abhidhamma emerged over time. And so one might expect, this is normally one would expect Sariputta to give as his answer a monk who's capable of giving quite detailed, quite analytical expositions of the Dhamma. But Sariputta was also a highly accomplished meditator. Sariputta, it seems, did not possess any of the supernormal or psychic powers. But he was able to move very smoothly through all of the jhanas, the formless attainments, into Nirodha Samapatti, the attainment of cessation. We see this in the Samyutta Nikaya. It's in volume 3. It could be chapter 27, 28, I think 28. It's the Sariputta Samyutta, the sayings of Sariputta, where he explains how in different occasions he would enter into one jhana, another jhana, one formless attainment or another formless attainment, but didn't have any attachment to it, no conceiving of I and mine. And so when Sariputta is called on to answer, he says, here a monk has mastery over his mind, and he doesn't let the mind wield mastery over him. And so in any part of the day, in the morning, he could enter into any meditative attainment he wants to. At midday, he could enter into any meditative state he wants to. In the evening, he could enter into any meditative state he wants to. And then he gives a simile to illustrate this. It's like a king or a royal minister or a movie actress or a fashion model who has a chest full of variously colored garments. In the morning, he could put on any pair of garments that he wants to. At midday, he could change and put on another pair of garments. In the evening, he could change again and put on another pair of garments. And so in the same way, this monk could enter into any meditative state he wants to at any time of day. Okay, so that's Sariputta's explanation. Then when Sariputta finishes, then he says in paragraph 10 that we've all spoken according to our own inspiration, our own ideals. Now let's go to the Buddha and report our discussion to him. And so then they eventually go to the Buddha. And then Venerable Sariputta relays the whole discussion that they've had to the Buddha. He explains each of their answers. And the Buddha commends each disciple for his answer on the ground that that is the particular skill or specialization of that disciple. And finally, after Sariputta finishes, this is at the end of paragraph 16, he relates his own statement, then he says to the Buddha, which of us has spoken well? Then the Buddha says, you have all spoken well, each of you in your own way, but let me give my explanation of what kind of monk could illuminate this Gosanga solitary forest. He says, here, a monk has returned from his alms round, then after his meal, he sits down, folds his legs crosswise, keeps his body erect, establishes mindfulness in front of him, and then he makes the resolution, I will not break the sitting position until my mind is liberated from all of the asavas, all of the taints or defilements through not clinging. Okay, that is the answer given here, and in a way that illustrates or exemplifies what the Buddha himself had done on the night of his enlightenment. He had his, first in the early part of the day, he had his meal. Then he found a pleasant spot to sit down, prepared a seat with grass. Then in the evening, he sat down, crossed his legs, and made that determination that I will not break or interrupt the sitting position until my mind is liberated through non-clinging. Yeah, that is the answer given in the Pali version. But in one of the Chinese versions, this is in the Ekuttara Agama, the Buddha praises the monk who sits down and not only makes the determination not to rise up until his mind is liberated from the asavas, but it's the monk who succeeds in fulfilling that resolution. So it's the monk who sits down, having made that resolution, liberates his mind from the asavas, from the defilements. That is the monk that the Buddha says can illuminate this Gosinga solitary forest. Okay, I went a little over this evening because I wanted to finish the sutta. Okay, now if there's any questions, I think we could go till 8:30. So if there's any questions, please feel welcome to ask. No questions? Yeah. I think actually maybe a better translation would be accumulates what he has heard. It means that after hearing it, he retains it in mind. He doesn't forget it. But it's something that whatever he hears gets built up until he has an accumulation of learning.
I thought it sort of sounded like he brings everything together. Also.
It doesn't seem to be the actual suggestion of the Pali expression. Sutta sannicheyo. Sutta means what is heard, and sannicheyo means, well, actually one might even see that in the prefix san. San has the sense of together. Nicheyo has a sense of accumulate or amass. But the prefix sang could suggest the idea of connecting what's been heard, connecting it together. So everything fits together into some kind of organic, integral whole, rather than just being discrete bits and pieces of knowledge that he picks up.
It's almost like he's picking up each different teaching, always seems to have a consistency in a lot of
it. Yeah, perhaps that is the sense.
What is the usefulness of having the divine eye? It doesn't seem useful for the Dharma? Like, how would you use it to make use?
Yeah, that's a good question. Okay, the question is, what kind of use would one make of the divine eye? Of course, I can't speak from personal experience. Okay. One function of the divine eye, when one can see the other realms of existence, this is when one is still in the stage of practicing for attainment, one could use the divine eye to see how living beings pass away from one realm, say the human realm, and then take rebirth in other realms. So one could see the continuity of life from one realm to another realm. And then this enables one to see the karmic connections between successive lives, and so one gets a clear first-hand understanding of the karmic connections, karmic relationships between different lives, the different lives through which a living being passes. And when, if that becomes extended far enough, then one can gain some sense of how this whole samsara is just a process of beings passing away and taking rebirth. One could see this directly for oneself. Also with the divine eye, since one could see, use it to see things that are occurring at a distance, one might be able to see, this is for somebody in the position of a teacher, whether there are any beings or people at a distance that one would be able to benefit with the Dhamma. Also somebody who has the ability to go to other realms of existence, like say Moggallana, I think Anuruddha has this ability too. One could, with the divine eye, one could see the beings in other realms of existence, and then one could understand whether those beings could benefit from hearing the Dhamma. And then one could, through the psychic power, one could go to that realm and then teach them.
One thing, I'm not sure if you covered this, but you had mentioned that Moggallana and Sariputta's answers are slightly odd given their recognized specialties.
Yeah.
Do you have a sense of what the purpose of that might be, the fact that they gave an unexpected answer?
Yeah, I don't think that Sariputta's answer is completely unexpected. And I think his answer is consistent in the parallel versions that have come in the Nikaya, so it seems to be part of the oldest established version of the text. I mean, it's also the case that Sariputta was able to enter quite easily into these different jhanic and formless meditations. And so then he's speaking about a skill that he has himself developed. In the case of Moggallana, it's really possible. This is a conjecture of Venerable Analeo, who's done studies of these different Agama versions, that three Chinese parallels and a Sanskrit fragment, in three Chinese parallels and a Sanskrit fragment, Moggallana praises the monk who excels in the psychic powers. And so it's quite possible that the Pali version has gotten a little mixed up here. Possible. But then the question would come, who was the one who originally spoke that statement about monks having a discussion? The Madhyama Agama, this is the Chinese parallel to the Majjhima Nikaya, attributes a statement to Mahakachayana. But now, Mahakachayana, one sees in the suttas, being a good speaker, but he usually doesn't participate in discussions. But his specialization is picking up on a short statement of the Buddha and then giving a detailed explanation of it. We see this in the Majjhima Nikaya Sutta number 18, Sutta number, could be 133, one of the Bodhaka Rutta Suttas, 133, 134, one of those suttas. And then in several suttas in the Saṅyutta Nikaya, volume 3, chapter 22. I think it's suttas 3, 4, something like that. So he'll take a brief statement of the Buddha, then explain it in detail. But he doesn't participate very much in discussions. But there's another monk that we see often engaging in discussions with Sariputta. His name is Mahakotita. He was a monk who was specially skilled in analytical knowledge. And in Sutta number 43, he engages in a discussion with Venerable Sariputta. I think earlier I mentioned that sutta and I said the conversation was between Sariputta and Moggallana. No, it's actually between Sariputta and Mahakotita. In many other places, in the Saṅyutta Nikāya, we see conversations between Sariputta and Mahakotita. So perhaps originally it was Mahakotita there, though he's not mentioned in any of the versions that have come down. Okay, any other questions? Yeah.
Each of the disciples was preeminent in some of that, as a meditator.
Each of these, yeah.
So how would you cap it off for the Buddha? What would you say about him?
As far as his specialization?
Like I know that he is a knower of this, tamer of that.
I think the Buddha said, Sabbakara Paripuno. He's one who is complete in all aspects.
I think it's assumed that all of them are arahants. The only one who isn't.
Yeah, except Ananda. Yep. But I should, where I said the Buddha is complete in all aspects, but the Buddha himself did not emphasize so much, I have to qualify it, so much the austere practices. Though he had done the ascetic practices before his enlightenment, carrying it to almost the ultimate extreme. But after his enlightenment as a teacher, he didn't observe some of these special austere practices, because if he were to do that, then it obstructs his ability to function as a teacher. Like the Buddha would often get invited to meals if he's saying, no, I don't accept invitations, I only go on Pindapata, then he's depriving householders of the opportunity to get the merits of offering him a meal. And also at the meal, usually there'll be a large group of people from the village or town will come, and then the Buddha will give a discourse after the meal. So then he's able to benefit many people with a discourse. Well, there's a book edited by some well-known monk. It's called Great Disciples of the Buddha, available from Wisdom Publications. You could just put in the search on Wisdom Publications, or even on Google, just Great Disciples of the Buddha, and you'll see it listed there. But the biographies are very, very interesting and very inspiring. So I highly recommend it. Okay, I think we'll have to stop now. Stop with the sharing of the merits. And next time we do sutta number 65 called Badali Sutta. In a way, that sutta shows that everything was not so smooth and harmonious in the Sangha, that there were problems from time to time, too. Okay, so let us end with the sharing of the merits. Akasata chabumata devanaga mahitika punyantang anumoditva Chirang rakantu sasanang akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika nyantang Chirang rakantu desanang akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva Chirang rakantu mang parang etavata cha hehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata cha hehi sampadang punya sampadang